Welcome to another episode of Targeted Talks, a podcast from Targeted Oncology. I'm your host, Nicole Tucker. In this episode, for a discussion on targeted therapies in ovarian cancer, whether administered in the community or academic setting, Dr. Sarah Temkin, a gynecologic oncologist at the Anne Arundel Medical Center, spoke with Dr. Daphne Stewart, an associate clinical professor and medical oncologist at the City of Hope Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Temkin begins the talk.
The treatment of ovarian cancer in the frontline has not really changed too much over the years. It still remains a combination of chemotherapy and surgery, although we have made some advances in terms of how we sequence these two things. 10 years ago, most patients had surgery first and chemotherapy second. And today in the United States, at least half of patients are receiving what we call neoadjuvant chemotherapy or chemotherapy prior to their surgery. Additionally, in the last few years, there have been a number of attempts to try to improve outcomes in the first line with using additional treatments. And so the PARP inhibitors this year and last year have been the agents that we've been working on incorporating into frontline therapy.
I quite agree with Dr. Temkin that we do have targeted agents that we've tried to introduce in the frontline, but up until now, they haven't made a major change in terms of both progression-free survival and overall survival in the all-comer population. We do see certainly a benefit to the use of PARP inhibitors in the frontline setting following surgery and chemotherapy in patients who are maintained on PARP inhibitors who harbor a germline or somatic BRCA mutation.
And then those PARP inhibitors have recently become FDA approved, even in patients without those main mutations. However, the magnitude of the benefit is not as great for those patients. I think this becomes a very personal conversation with the patient regarding what their goals of care are and how much they value a treatment-free interval. We still know that most patients with ovarian cancer will have a relatively long disease-free interval, yet, and even though the PARP inhibitors appear to be extending those disease-free intervals, most patients will still have a recurrence at some point in time. And so the timing of PARP inhibitor therapy still remains, at least to me, pretty unclear over the course of a woman's life with ovarian cancer.
I think that that's a good point. So for patients who don't harbor a BRCA germline mutation or a somatic mutation or demonstrate homologous repair deficiency, there are prospective trials that show an improvement in disease-free survival in the upfront setting. However, as you pointed out, it's modest. And for patients who are at very high risk for recurrence, such as patients with later stage disease, perhaps those stage fours who were optimally debulked, but you know just by the fact that they were stage four at diagnosis, they're at very high risk for earlier recurrence. Those are the patients that I primarily would offer PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy to. Patients with earlier stage disease who undergo debulking and successful full dose chemotherapy can have quite prolonged remissions without maintenance therapy. And I think those are really the patients that are controversial. And again, I think that in my own practice and in my institution's practice, we tend to delay exposure to the PARP inhibitors until the recurrent setting.
And I think we learned a little bit from our experience with bevacizumab as maintenance, although this is a little bit of a different setting. I think when bevacizumab was first introduced into the treatment of ovarian cancer, a lot of patients were getting bevacizumab in the initial frontline setting. And over the years, once the results of GOG-218 and ICON-7 were presented, we've come to a point where it's used about 25% of the time, and generally in those same patients that Dr. Stewart was just mentioning have stage four disease, who may not have a complete response to initial cytotoxic chemotherapy and surgery, or patients with high volume stage 4 disease. Those are the patients at least that I will consider some type of maintenance in the frontline setting as more likely beneficial than a chemotherapy holiday.
I would just like to add that patients who present with high volume ascites or pleural effusions, I think also fall into the category pleural effusions, making them stage 4, but initial presentation of high volume ascites, I am a little bit more eager to use bevacizumab in the frontline. It seems that those patients get a bigger benefit.
You know, I think also over this year, we've had sort of disappointing results from immunotherapy in the frontline setting for these patients with ovarian cancer. And so, you know, I'm curious to see what comes next, certainly in figuring out a way that our patients could possibly see some of the benefits of immunotherapy that we've seen in other disease sites.
The role of mutations and mutational testing for patients with epithelial ovarian cancer, testing at this point, I think, is crucial. ASCO published its guidelines in February of 2020, recommending that both germline and somatic testing be undertaken for all patients with epithelial ovarian cancer. This primarily applies to the serous carcinoma category, but we know that patients with alternative histologies also have fairly impressive incidences of both germline and somatic mutations when they are diagnosed. And given the impact of PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy, it implores that providers actually undertake the testing at the time of diagnosis instead of waiting for relapse. We know that amongst high-grade serous carcinoma, approximately 13 to 15% of patients will actually harbor a germline BRCA1 or 2 mutation. And we know that the somatic mutation rate is about 7%. So you've got nearly one quarter of patients who will benefit with the addition of PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy following upfront chemotherapy.
And I would agree with that. I think this is quite exciting that we have these mutational markers. It goes well beyond what we thought about in terms of genetic testing just a few years ago, in that it's so much more than cascade testing. And having this information not only from the germline, but also from the tumor itself is so crucial to making these decisions in the upfront setting about whether maintenance is appropriate or not appropriate and the magnitude of the benefit that would be expected from maintenance therapy. I would just add to that that we've really had an implementation problem with genetic testing in ovarian cancer, and even though genetic testing for ovarian cancer has been guideline recommended since 2013 universally, less than a third of all patients nationally are tested. And those testing rates are really linked to insurance and race and ethnicity. And, you know, I think it's an imperative that we find ways to implement this really critical test to all of our patients.
I think it wasn't so long ago that we couldn't even get approval for genetic testing. I mean, I recognize that you point out 2013, but insurance companies were often slow to cover the service of doing even germline testing in the BRCA mutant carriers. Obviously, the benefit long ago was identifying those patients who might benefit from additional prophylactic interventions, but certainly to identify family members who would also be at high risk for further cancers. The fact that we now are able to also demonstrate a benefit in somatic mutations makes things a step more difficult, because you do require undertaking the genetic testing and then sending the resected tumor tissue or biopsy tissue for the somatic testing. And it really becomes a two-step approach. And I think that the somatic testing is largely saved until relapse, at least in practices kind of on the West Coast that I've observed. So this getting the news out about the importance of the benefit of somatic testing, I think we're still in the early days of this, and we have to make our colleagues in the communities understand the importance of doing this dual testing for all. And I think as the testing platforms become more widely available, hopefully they will become cheaper and there will be fewer barriers maybe to getting these results. But it's just really exciting that we can get this testing, we have a treatment that we understand how to use at this point, that is tolerable, that is effective. The results by themselves are quite prognostic. They're certainly prognostic of the response and duration of response to PARP inhibitor therapy, but also prognostic of the response to upfront platinum therapy and therapy at relapse. So it's just a hugely useful result in order to inform patients of kind of what their ovarian cancer treatment future looks like.
Yeah, and I think even in the future of this, you know, we may be even able to become so much more granular in this. There was a study at ASCO this year, a follow-up to Ariel 3, looking at the exceptional responders and the type and homozygosity of the BRCA mutation seems to have made a difference in terms of response to PARP inhibitors. So I think there's still more to come on this, and we're becoming increasingly sophisticated with time.
We were also going to talk about the importance of the homologous recombination deficiency, which I will be honest, I still don't understand very well. I don't really understand the platform, how the results are being kind of lumped into a formula in order to determine a score for homologous recombination deficiency. But this actually has been hugely useful in expanding the population of patients who can be identified who also will benefit from PARP inhibitor therapy. What are your thoughts about that, Dr. Temkin? Do you ever have a hard time identifying patients who are homologous recombination deficient, or when you read your genetic results?
I think it is a little confusing in that, you know, at first it had been linked to the FDA approval of rucaparib, the test, and so we started doing that to identify patients who were eligible for rucaparib, and then it became not as important anymore. And now, you know, with sort of more universal access to PARP inhibitors and trying to help patients decide, and even deciding myself who I think I should recommend PARP inhibitor therapy to in the first line setting, it's become another tool that we have. So I do send the test pretty frequently. If someone has a germline mutation identified, I don't necessarily send their tissue for somatic testing. But I think that's one of the other implementation challenges is, you know, each one of these tests take time, and getting the sequence right and whether the patient has upfront surgery or neoadjuvant therapy may change the timing of this. And, you know, you don't want to be scrambling at the end of six cycles trying to get the test results. Trying to do them earlier has, at least from my practice, been helpful.
So we talked about earlier that the germline plus the somatic BRCA mutations make up about a quarter of patients with high-grade ovarian cancer. But when you throw in the remainder of these homologous recombination deficient patients, you get to nearly half of all patients, which is really exciting. Although I will say that when I send those tests for HRD, I'm devastated when I end up with the coin flip, right, between heads or tails. And I'm devastated when I end up with the not deficient, because I always think to myself, wait a second, if we could throw this back in the blender, there's got to be a way to call this, you know, deficient, right? Because that's sort of the fundamental basis of cancer, right? That you have these chromosomal breaks that can't be adequately repaired. And therefore, I would just expect even more patients. I think that the workflow that you point out has to be streamlined again so that these tests are done in the upfront setting. Unfortunately, even patients with germline BRCA mutations, who we know are the most sensitive to platinum therapies and the most sensitive to PARP inhibitors, we know that after they've been exposed to multiple lines of therapy in the relapse setting, they're just not as sensitive anymore. So if we're going to use these targeted agents appropriately and we're going to choose the patients that are going to get the biggest benefit, we have to be able to do it early on, shortly following their diagnosis.
Over the last few years, we've really had an exorbitant number of clinical trials of adding agents to upfront therapy in ovarian cancer. And one of those was GOG-218, which was a randomized trial of the addition of bevacizumab to carboplatin and paclitaxel in patients with advanced ovarian cancer. Patients were additionally randomized in a third arm to bevacizumab plus carboplatin and paclitaxel, followed by maintenance bevacizumab. And although there was initially a lot of enthusiasm for this combination because a progression-free survival advantage was obtained with maintenance bevacizumab over time, and as the data matured, we unfortunately found that there wasn't an overall survival advantage. And simultaneous to this trial was a similar trial performed in Europe, the ICON 7 trial, which had very similar results. And I think this really demonstrates one of the difficulties in all of the trials in ovarian cancer. There's no doubt that bevacizumab is a useful drug in the management of ovarian cancer. However, the timing of it and when to use it is definitely still not standard for every patient. The use of bevacizumab also has some toxicity for some patients more than others, and deciding what drug to give to what patient at what time in their disease course is, I think, become increasingly difficult with the PARP inhibitors. Although overall it's great news for our patients that we have these new drugs that are useful, I think we're still all struggling to find the exact time to insert these into therapy.
Bevacizumab is also complicated when we're talking about the frontline setting, given the point that you made, Dr. Temkin, about the use of neoadjuvant therapy, right? So it's hard to give patients triplet therapy that includes bevacizumab around the time that you're planning on taking them to surgery, just because they have to safely go to surgery and have appropriate wound healing. They have to have a couple of cycles worth of a break from their bevacizumab, and then they can't immediately go back on afterwards. So I sort of struggle when I do feel like I have a high risk patient who maybe is going to benefit from that 4 month, maybe improvement in progression-free survival when they're a stage four, or again, somebody with high risk ascites or bilateral pleural effusions. I might want to use the Avastin, but I think it's a little bit tricky in the upfront setting. And it seems like from our trials, we know that the Avastin maintenance alone, if you just give chemotherapy, really doesn't add anything to the progression-free survival. So it needs to be given, I think the trials have shown us, in this combination. I think there was a lot of enthusiasm. There still is a role also, I think, in inducing a rapid response. So we know that the bevacizumab increases the response rate when you give it in combination with chemotherapy. And certainly for people who are highly symptomatic, that may be a useful consideration up front.
Yeah, I would add that on top of the issue of patients getting neoadjuvant chemotherapy more commonly now than they were at the time that patients were enrolled onto GOG-218, we also now choose neoadjuvant chemotherapy typically for patients who I think of as most at risk for toxicity related to bevacizumab. So older patients or patients who with suboptimal performance status or nutritional status. And so I think in my own personal practice, I've been adding bevacizumab later if the patient is going to be a candidate. It also gives you a chance to sort of see how the patient's going to respond to chemotherapy without bevacizumab. And it, although it's not exactly the way the trials have been designed, I think it's still a useful drug for some patients.
And also the risk of bowel perforation is fair. And so a lot of the time you can't see on typical staging exams, disease that is involving kind of full thickness bowel wall, you may miss that and underestimate a patient's risk for bowel perforation. And by plunging ahead with Avastin, you will put a fair number of patients at real risk for bowel perforation. So I do think that in that neoadjuvant setting, it feels risky.
Yeah, so now also all these patients are eligible for a PARP inhibitor maintenance instead of bevacizumab, and bevacizumab can be saved for later on in the disease course for the time of recurrence as patients need it. And that's based upon both the SOLO-1 and NOVA trial. the SOLO-1 trial was in upfront patients with BRCA mutations, and those patients had a really significant benefit in progression-free survival when they went on to PARP inhibitor maintenance following their initial therapy with surgery and chemotherapy. And the NOVA trial demonstrated a benefit for all patients, regardless of BRCA status. And so those two therapies have now been FDA approved. And so I'm curious if you can comment on what patients you're using the PARP inhibitors in for maintenance in the first line.
I would use PARP inhibitor maintenance in the first line for anyone with a germline BRCA mutation or a somatic BRCA mutation or homologous repair deficiency. You know, we have a number of trials that we can discuss. I think the data is fairly robust, that those are the patients that really benefit. It's those 50% who aren't HRD, even though there are trials that have shown a few month benefit in progression-free survival, those I tend to offer the drug and let them consider whether or not they want to undertake the drug's toxicities or whether they want to save it for recurrence there.
Right, and then we do have very good data, at least for in the platinum sensitive recurrent setting, that the PARP inhibitors can extend progression-free survival in both the BRCA population and the non-BRCA population of patients, both from the SOLO2 data and also the niraparib data on that. Both are FDA approved in the platinum sensitive recurrent setting.
And I guess a question that comes up, but we don't really know the answer to, is there a role for retreatment with PARP inhibitor? So if you have used the PARP inhibitor as a maintenance approach in upfront treatment, so patients who undergo debulking surgery with definitive platinum-based chemotherapy in the front line, who are then placed on a PARP inhibitor for maintenance therapy, if they have a platinum-sensitive relapse, can you retreat them with platinum therapy back to a response? And, you know, what then is the role for future PARP inhibitor? I think the answer is probably going to be that it's not going to be effective in all patients, although, as you pointed out, there are certain people with really robust responses, and you could expect that maybe they would respond again. It is kind of disappointing that when you reintroduce a PARP inhibitor or when you try to use an alternative PARP following, so you try to use niraparib and somebody who maybe had earlier exposure to olaparib, there really is no significant response rate at that retreatment.
And I think like with the SOLO2 data being recently presented, I was actually struck by the low number of patients that crossed over. And that, of course, was a trial of BRCA mutation carriers who were treated with maintenance olaparib after a platinum-sensitive response, partial or complete response to cytotoxic chemotherapy. And only 38% of patients who were enrolled onto the placebo arm crossed over and got a PARP inhibitor later. And so it raises my own personal curiosity as to whether if all of the patients had crossed over, if we would have seen a slightly different overall survival curve.
Yeah, I think good point. The other trials, the competitor trials, seem to be weighed down by the crossover effect. So the, you know, whether or not the overall survival will be demonstrated in those is quite questionable because such a large number of patients were allowed to cross over.
And then also in GY004, which was, you know, the PARP inhibitor versus PARP plus cediranib versus chemotherapy that was also recently presented, we did see that of the patients who had BRCA mutations, overall response rate was 90% to olaparib alone. And so I just keep getting stuck on the timing of therapy if responses are so high in the treatment setting for the women with BRCA mutations.
Yeah, I agree with you. It also just begs the question, if you have someone, for example, with a germline mutation who has a profound response to platinum doublet chemotherapy alone, let's say, and let's just say for the sake of the argument that you're at a center where you even sprinkle in some HIPEC, for example, because you treat them in the neoadjuvant setting, the point that I'm making is maybe you can get the same response or even a longer response if you give them that PARP inhibitor at their second relapse, right? Because maybe they're going to have a prolonged remission and then they may have a second relapse where they remain exquisitely sensitive to platinum therapy and you expose them to their PARP maintenance at that point. And, you know, isn't it possible that by sequencing it a little bit differently, as you pointed out, that you may actually increase the overall survival, you know, your time to subsequent therapies and give them treatment free intervals. I'm actually kind of hung up on the idea that you have to treat somebody who's so sensitive to platinum therapy and is likely or, you know, statistically likely to have a fairly long treatment-free interval without maintenance therapy. I'm wondering if for patients being off treatment and still being sensitive to the drugs in later lines without compromising survival may be a preferable strategy, but we don't have any trials that sort of compare that later sequence.
Yeah, I hope we continue learning. And I think one of the biggest benefits to ovarian cancer treatment has always been, or for me personally, as a physician treating women with ovarian cancer, what I've always enjoyed is telling patients to go away for 3 months and not have to think about me. And I'm missing it.
You know, I think that is a important point. Can I just add to that and say that those 3 month interval breaks, you know, you don't have to come into clinic and be under constant surveillance. We're going to let you have those vacations, really are different from those every 2 week CBCs that you're getting when you put patients initially on a PARP inhibitor until they're sort of at a stable dose. It is impressive to me the number of my patients who require red blood cell transfusion support because we're trying just to get them to a stable dosing on any of the available PARP inhibitors. It's hard on these ladies after they've had so much chemotherapy. I know that the registration trials really gave them a up to 12-week chemotherapy break, but it seems like some of them really chomping at the bit to get onto their PARP inhibitor. And the timing of when you start it also really impacts how much hematologic toxicity they experience. I think if you let their marrows fully recover, they seem to tolerate it better. If you start it a little bit too early, they don't recover quite as well, and they're at risk of anemia and thrombocytopenia and both bleeding and needing red blood cell transfusions. I think it, you know, it kind of makes me uncomfortable in older women, certainly older women who've been exposed to platinum doublet therapy. And when I say older, I mean that very common over age 70 who's been diagnosed with stage 3 or 4 ovarian cancer. These are women who are just as likely to respond to younger women. However, I do think that they're at higher risk of side effects, and subgroup analyses have shown that they do require greater numbers of dose reductions. Really reading kind of the granular details of some of these clinical trials, you know, it's pretty dramatic how largely there were over 50% requirements for dose reductions in these PARP inhibitor maintenance settings. So the upfront settings, not quite 50%, but at relapse when patients have had 2 courses of platinum doublet chemotherapy, there was, you know, sometimes as many as 75% of patients who required PARP inhibitor dose reductions. And that really doesn't even take into account the dose holds that probably most people have to go through, and those patients that I'm describing who require even red blood cell support to get them through their initial months of therapy.
And the average age of an ovarian cancer patient in the US is in their mid-60s. So it's a really substantial number of patients who are older and frail and may have different goals of care.
Also, as you point out, that risk of AML, not well studied yet, I think, because we haven't used these drugs for long enough, but patients who are multiply pretreated seem to clearly be at higher risk. So getting back to my question before, can you sequence things differently and hold the PARPs until later? That actually may be, you know, detrimental to certain patients who are at risk of bone marrow failure. I would just like to start giving the details about the SOLO-1 trial, which I think is sort of the granddaddy trial, which has really changed my practice. And this was a phase 3 randomized trial, which looked at germline mutated BRCA patients who were treated with frontline Taxol with carboplatin for 6 cycles, followed by maintenance olaparib. And the olaparib dosing was originally, I think, in capsule dosing at 400 milligrams BID. Subsequent trials looked at a slightly different dosing regimen, but they looked at the 3-year rate of progressive disease or death due to any cause. And amongst patients who took the maintenance therapy, the three-year survival was actually 60% compared with just 27% of patients who were randomized to the maintenance placebo arm. Of note, the risk of AML associated with olaparib use was 1% and was not seen amongst placebo patients. So I thought that that doubling of really survival free of ovarian cancer at 3 years through the use of olaparib was a stunning result and really changed my practice.
So I completely agree. And I think that the results of that trial really far exceeded expectations. And it really just demonstrates how well the PARP inhibitors work in women with particularly with BRCA mutations. SOLO 2 was actually the trial which led to the initial FDA approval of olaparib and was a trial of maintenance therapy with olaparib following a complete or partial response to platinum-based therapy for women with platinum-sensitive disease. In that trial, the progression-free survival was significantly better for women on maintenance PARP inhibitor, and the hazard ratio for progression was 0.3. The final overall survival data was just presented at ASCO and demonstrated improvement in overall survival for women who received the PARP inhibitor. The confidence interval for the result crossed 1, but was just at 1. And when you looked at all of the women with a known BRCA mutation, there were 3 patients who never had a confirmed BRCA mutation. This did become statistically significant.
Yeah, that number also just is stunning and definitely changed my practice, that you could really have these long-term exceptional responders who were able to maintain a remission and really tolerate the therapy well while maintaining a very high quality of life. It's really altered kind of our expectations for patients with ovarian cancer. The SOLO 3 trial, I also think, is kind of interesting because this was a phase 3 trial amongst patients with germline BRCA mutations who were treated with non-platinum therapy at a platinum-sensitive relapse. So they basically hit their first platinum-sensitive relapse, and it was kind of looking at, you know, was olaparib better than alternative chemotherapy? And the response rate, so this is a non-chemotherapy treatment at first relapse, was dramatically higher amongst patients who took the PARP inhibitor versus patients who took alternative therapy. Now, granted, they weren't giving carboplatin therapy, but I think the overall response rate was something like 75% with a progression-free survival of 13 months just with single agent olaparib. I'm not sure that that's the best way clinically to do things. I think that the SOLO 2 results where you retreated patients with platinum sensitive disease with another platinum doublet, I think you're going to get a deeper response and more effective prolongation of survival with a maintenance approach. But if you had a patient who was unable to tolerate subsequent therapy for any number of reasons, knowing that a PARP inhibitor as a single agent can be that effective is very encouraging.
And like I mentioned, we saw confirmation of this in the results of GY004, where there was a 90% overall response rate for those women who carried a germline BRCA mutation. So I think for those patients that do have a germline mutation, there may not be a benefit. And this is what we saw in those results. There's not really a benefit to adding a second agent or combination therapy because the patients are so likely to respond to single agent therapy. I'm not sure if everyone agrees with me on that, but that's how I read those studies.
I actually agree with you. I think the patients who have the germline BRCA mutations really do well on the single agent, but the room for improvement are in those who are either unknown or who we know are not BRCA mutation carriers, or who are HRD negative. But can those patients benefit from a PARP in combination with something? And I think that's really an interesting future for us to study.
Yeah, those olaparib trials have really been repeated with both NRAP in the upfront and platinum sensitive settings with both the PRIMA and the NOVA trial and had very similar results. I think the difference was that the trials using niraparib did not only treat BRCA positive patients, but all patients were treated. The trials were designed in a way that was really nicely able to demonstrate a benefit for all patients. The magnitude of the benefit, as we mentioned already, was the greatest for those patients with germline or somatic mutations.
For the niraparib trials, I think the most important one being the frontline maintenance PRIMA trial did look at all those three groups of patients, right? So it looked at all patients with high-grade serous ovarian cancer, or mostly serous, right? But there were some high-grade, I guess, endometrioids included. There were more than 700 patients on that PRIMA trial, and they had three groups. They had patients who had germline BRCA mutations. They had patients who had no germline BRCA mutation, but were homologous recombination deficient. And then they had the wild types, basically, who were negative for HRD. And it really teased out kind of in terms of benefit that there really are two groups, HRD and BRCA segregate together. And those patients get a substantial benefit with like a progression-free survival benefit of 10 or 12 months versus placebo. While patients who don't have a germline BRCA mutation and who are not homologous recombination deficient really get a 4 to 5 month progression-free survival benefit. So I think that you point out very importantly that all groups benefit, but the magnitude of benefit is very different between the groups. And patients with germline BRCA and HRD are almost interchangeable in terms of their benefit.
And so now we have also have results of several trials combining PARP inhibitors with bevacizumab or with anti-angiogenic agents. What we've seen is that for patients receiving olaparib plus bevacizumab in the Paola trial, as well as patients receiving niraparib and bevacizumab in the platinum-sensitive relapse setting, that there is activity to this combination combined.
In particular, in those patients who are HRD negative, right, or who don't have evidence of homologous recombination deficiency, they have a pretty significant benefit from the combination therapy. I think that the ANOVA trial or AVANOVA 2 trial is the one that looks at niraparib plus bevacizumab, which treated women with platinum sensitive relapse with this non-platinum or non-chemotherapy containing regimen. And it improved, you know, progression-free survival and the time to, you know, next subsequent treatment rather substantially. And it was independent of HRD. So people with or without the homologous recombination deficiency did very, very well.
So I think many of the same questions are arising as we had for single agent therapy in terms of what drugs and at what time and when to use combination therapy compared to monotherapy.
I think I tend to still really rely on combination platinum therapy being associated with the highest response rate in patients who do not have germline or somatic BRCA mutations. And so I tend to favor the combination targeted therapies, or as we pointed out, the PARP inhibitor only approaches in patients who are HRD positive or the germline BRCA or somatic BRCA carriers. Whereas in all other patients, I still tend to prescribe lots of chemotherapy, and I'm holding off on the targeted combination therapy for now.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And then of course we always, you know, aim to have patients who are eligible enter into clinical trials.